This episode is brought to you by Sterling Soap Company. How often do you think about your soap? Well, if you answered, not much, maybe you should. You see, a lot of what passes for soap in stores is technically not soap, according to the FDA's definition. It's full of lab-created chemicals and detergents because, well, it's cheaper to make. Now, what if you could buy natural soap made from natural ingredients like tallow, palm oil, coconut oil, and scented with essential oils, and for just a little more than you'd pay for grocery store soap? Sterling soap is 100% natural, and with a wide variety of bath soaps, shave soaps, beard balm, lotions, and cologne, there's a product and a scent for just about everybody. Check them out for yourself at sterlingsoap.com. That's STIRLING soap.com.
Tonight, we'll go back in time to seasons past, when 22 men graced the record fields of yesterday, fighting for one more first down, one more yard gain, one final score, but that would bring victory after 60 minutes of battle on the gridiron. Tonight, we'll explore the world of gridiron greats, and welcome to Gridiron Greats, football history and its memorabilia on the Sports History Network in conjunction with Swick Enterprises, and we're live from the Southport, North Carolina home of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'm Bob Swick, publisher and editor of Gridiron Greats Magazine, and I'll be your host for the show. Gridiron Greats is the only publication in America that focuses upon the history and memorabilia of the North American football game since its inception in 1869. We cover 150 plus years of football history and memorabilia, and you can find us on the web at gridirongreatsmagazine.com. It is at this time I'd like to introduce my co-host. He's a senior contributing writer to Gridiron Greats Magazine, a football memorabilia historian specializing in pre-World War II items, in particular Red Grange, and also Seattle Seahawk items, in particular Steve Largent. He hails from Portland, Oregon, Mr. Joe Squires. Joe, welcome to the show.
Outstanding. Happy to be here. You're on your game today, Captain.
Thank you. I am here again. We're back with another podcast, and we're going to start off with a mixed bag of results out of Seattle, Washington professional sports.
Yep.
And you are the expert on Seattle, so I'm going to hand it off to get started here.
I would say Mike Blaisdell is the expert on Seattle, but I'll take a silver medal in that happily.
Mike's not here right now, though. You are the expert right now.
Good point. The current expert. Yeah. As I was texting you and our little football nerd group, Monday was a very busy day for a Seattle fan. Seahawks played on Monday Night Football, game two of Monday Night Football, which that's a whole nother topic. The game one, which started at 3:30 or 4 o'clock my time. And then game two,
7 o'clock our time.
Yeah, so 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock mine, which then game two, which started at 7 and ended at a little after 10 my time. I don't know how you East Coast.
We don't. We don't. There's no possible way. And I go back to when I used to work. I used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I left the house at 5:30. There's no possible way I could watch a game that late. And the only games I would really watch are the Packers. The game we get over 11:30 at night, and I would basically take a nap and get ready and go to work the next day. So it's poor, really poor marketing, in my opinion, and to the fans of other time zones to have a game that late.
They got to pander to one or the other. I mean, either we're getting off early over here to watch the game, or you guys are stamped for midnight. I think I've told you before, I went to a Monday Night Football game in 2005 in Philadelphia. Seahawks, that was the year the Seahawks went to the Super Bowl. Tangent here, but that's what this show is all about. And Stacy and I go to a bar in Philadelphia. We're going to grab dinner before we head to the game. About 5 o'clock, we're like, all right, let's get it. Let's get out of here. I mean, we're dressed in Seahawk jerseys. She's wearing a Matt Hasselbeck. I'm, of course, wearing Steve Largent. And the bartender's like, where are you guys going? We're going to the game. He's like, the game doesn't start till 8:30. I forget what the time was.
Basically 9 o'clock.
3 hours. We're like, what? We're so used to the game starting at 5 or 6 o'clock when you get home from work here,
Right.
that we just forgot to include a 3 hour time difference. So
Right.
needless to say, we had to sit in the bar for another 3 hours, passing the time somehow. But anyways, as I mentioned, Seattle Seahawks had the game 2 on Monday Night Football against the Houston Texans. Sam Darnold attempted to lose the game that was looking good by fumbling in the end zone to keep Texans in the game. But at the same time, the Seattle Mariners, and we don't talk very often about that other game where they hit a
Right,
long
right.
ball with a stick, but the Seattle Mariners were in the American League Championship Series, which is the equivalent of the AFC Championship against
Correct.
Toronto, against Toronto, and we lost. So we were up at one point, 2 games to nil, gave away 2 games, 3 games to 2. Then they tied it 3 games to 3. They play best of seven there, and then we lost it. So we lost 2 games in a row to lose for a chance to go on to the World Series. So my
Right.
son Xander's like, Seahawks won. I'm like, I would have taken a Seahawk loss for the Mariners to
Yeah.
go to the World Series for the first time ever.
That's kind of sad. I feel bad for Mariner fans because, I mean, they've never been in the World Series.
Never,
This was probably their best year ever to get into the
yeah.
World Series. And Toronto just got a lot of momentum and
Yeah.
they became unstoppable. So
Yeah.
I feel bad for you guys because, again, that's a lot of years to lose someone and so forth.
Yeah.
But
Blue Jays looked good, but who knows?
I gotta make one comment. Talking about Seahawks, I was watching on Sunday the Chiefs Raiders
Oh
game,
my gosh.
and seeing Pete Carroll and saying to myself, "What is he doing there? And why did they hire him? Because to me, the team is just so totally tuned
Oh.
out of anything that he's saying or doing, and they're not buying into anything." That was probably one of the worst games I've seen in a long, long time.
Scratch that. I was in Las Vegas the week before that,
Oh, okay. That's
and
right. That's right. Forget
remember I
about that.
texted you a photo, and it was Raiders against, God, who did they play? It was so bad. I mean, the Raiders looked horrible, and I'm
Was
like,
it the Rams? No,
no,
not the Rams. I can't think of it.
I forget. And the highlight of it was they retired Eric Allen's number at halftime,
Right,
and they
right.
trotted out a bunch of Hall of Famers, which was really cool. Marcus Allen was there,
Right,
which
right.
and I'm kind of talking to my a couple friends who are big football fans, and I'm like, got to be kind of weird because Marcus Allen was unceremoniously ran out of town by Al Davis when he hired, when he drafted, Bo Jackson, and he
Yep.
made Marcus Allen, run fullback. Eric Dickerson was there. I'm like, what did he have, 1 or 2 years at LA? Because he was a Ram and then he went to Indianapolis. And man, I didn't even
Yeah.
know that. I sent you guys a picture of Jerry Rice in their Wall
Right.
of Fame. They have Jerry Rice as a Hall of Famer, and I'm like, he played here one. No, he played 2 years there, and
Two
he
years. Two years.
mired
Yep.
in quagmire before he graduated onto the Seahawks, where they unretired number 80, Steve Larchinster. Anyways, they just abysmal football, and I'm like, the only thing that makes the Raiders look even less sucky here is the other team they played. It was so unforgettable. I can't even remember who the team was. We left, 5 minutes into the fourth quarter. It was so bad.
Wow. And that's a no-no. That's a no-no in my book because if I go to a game,
Be
I
committed.
stay to the bitter end. I mean, I'll
Yeah.
maybe get up in the last minute or so just to start, making the trek out. But
Yeah. Well, I was driving to Phoenix from Las Vegas after the
oh
game. I
boy.
wanted to get a jump on that
Oh
to
boy.
start a
Wow.
convention I was going to. But yeah, so oh well, they always say next year, but they threw a stat up and it was like number of teams that haven't been to the championship game per sport. And
Yep.
obviously there's, 4 or 5, I forget how many teams in the NFL that have never been to the Super Bowl. And then they moved over to baseball and it was like there's one team and all of Major League Baseball that's never been to the World Series, and that's Seattle. That was kind of a tough stat. whenever they say, go back next year, you realize how hard it is to even get there.
Right.
So, and by the way, in the world of nicknames, our catcher, Cal Raleigh, has the nickname Big Dumper.
Right, right.
Which is in reference to his big butt, which
yeah.
makes, yeah. which kind of cracks me up. And I was talking to my son about, great nicknames, Lou the Toe Groza, Concrete Charlie.
Yeah.
Those are pretty good nicknames. If you're called Concrete Charlie, yeah. that's not so bad. Big Dumper. That's,
yeah.
it
well,
is
I think it's a sign of the times. I mean, that's it. I mean, we're not, it's not overly complimentary. So, whatever. I don't know. The guy's a good catcher. He's a good hitter. I mean,
I'm glad. Yeah. Yeah. It's weird to see his name
flash. Notch him a little more.
Greats who've hit 60 home runs. Yeah. Just kind of interesting. Oh, well. Next
now,
year.
The other thing we're going to mention, when we both commented on this, there are no auctions going on, basically.
Yeah.
But I want to point out one thing, though. I think it was either last week or the week before, REA had an auction, and there were some Mayos in it. And I cannot believe the prices of low-grade Mayos right now. They are absolutely through the roof. And I really don't know why. Obviously, there's some collecting going on of them or whatever.
Yeah.
But I just cannot believe. I think it was a PSA 1.5. What the juice went for over 2,700. And I was just totally shocked seeing it, which basically means the stuff I got, which is a little better grade, even though it's all an SGC. I'm wondering maybe I should just start unloading everything right now.
Yeah. You and Brenda need a new pool.
No, we don't need a pool, but
Dan Fouts did.
I wouldn't mind the condo in Florida as a getaway. That's the only thing. So, I'm shocked by it. I'm just totally shocked to see.
I was watching. It was a little un-REA-esque. I mean, I still have in my mind, when REA did one auction a year. I mean, and it was just incredible.
Right, right.
And they do several a year. They're still good, but this one was a little un-REA-esque. It was just there were a few good things, but it was a lot of mired in mediocrity. And, well, as you mentioned, we called it the winter of auctions. There's just not much going on right now. Heritage has one. It ends in 2 days, and I'm watching some unopened wax in that one. As you can see, I have my wax display. I've been on a kick of that the last 7-8 years. Hunt opened up. Hunt, which breaks. I wrote down they solved what's never been a problem by breaking football down into 9 categories. And it's ridiculous. And then you don't know, should I click on search? But if you click on search after you drop down to category, it defaults to the main page. You have to just click on the search and wait for it to. I mean, it literally 9 categories. It's ridiculous. You want bobbleheads? That's a category. It's ridiculous. Memorabilia, game used. So, yeah, solved a problem that's never been a problem by making me click on 9 different categories to make sure I don't miss some esoteric item that has an autograph that they threw in autographs instead of general football. So Hunt has something coming up. Not a lot in there. A Mile High just popped. 392 football items. And the number one item, I wrote this down so I could make you laugh, Captain, which is my favorite hobby. The number one marquee item in football was a 2024 Prism Cherry Blossom Choice Jaden Davidson card, PSA 9. Let me repeat that in case you're writing it down. 2024 Prism Cherry Blossom Choice.
Oh, my Lord.
Number
give
two
me
card.
A break.
Yeah.
Well, again, I showed my select few group what was available in Costco yesterday.
Totally. Totally.
2025 Donruss apparently holiday pack, 8 packs of 10 cards each, unopened, and an oversized card for a mere $54.95. And you were only limited to 2 purchases. So I'm looking at it. I took the picture, and some guy's looking at me, and he says, "Are you sending the picture to somebody?" I said, "Yeah," because I said, I can't believe they would have something like this here. And I really wonder who's going to buy this. And he says, oh, that seems like a nice gift if you collect cards. I said, really? I said, this makes no sense to me. It's not even a wax box, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
8 packs?
You were that close.
$5?
Saying, get out of my damn hobby.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Seems like a nice gift. What are you, crazy? I don't know anyone who'd buy this for you. Yeah,
it's just not. And then Brenda says, well, why don't you buy the two and open them up? I said, I refuse to spend $100 plus.
Well, thank you, John. When I replied, you know, gone are the days of plunking a dollar down and getting 4 quarter packs.
Yeah.
Thanks to John Spano for putting that in the inflation adjusted calculator to let us realize.
Yeah, 90, you know, a dollar, you know, there is no low end pack that any kid could buy. If a kid walked into a Walmart, there is nothing that kid could buy for less than $5. Yeah. I mean, that's the reality of the situation. And if the dollar stores, which at one time they actually marketed, you know, 4 card, 5 card packs for a dollar. Those are all gone too. So, you know, obviously it's not a hobby. It's a lottery. That's basically what it is today. You know,
I don't know. I mean, and we've talked about it before, but I mean, if you want to attract new customers, if you need your new wave of customers coming in, it has to be attractive, it has to be priced attractively enough,
right?
You know, to get kids in. I mean, you know, a dollar to me when I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 wasn't that tough. That was really easy to steal out of my mom's purse when she wasn't looking. But $50,
I mean, it doesn't make any sense to me. It really doesn't. It's sad. It really is sad. It's taken a lot of fun, you know. And again, I've taken a lot of fun out of collecting for the simple reason: guys like me, and I'm sure a lot of guys my age. You know, back in the 90s and 00s and 10s, we would, you know, go to a Walmart or go to a card shop if it was around, or go to a store or a show, and we saw some dollar packs. Yeah, we'd buy them and, you know, break them. You know, that's it. You know, and it's nothing we liked. We saw a young kid at the show or whatever and gave them to him and, you know, here, have some free cards type of thing. Yeah. Today, the cards get thrown in the garbage, as I've seen, and, you know, forget it, you know. Not good.
Firsthand at several shows,
Not good, not good, not a good situation. All right, we can't solve all the problems of the hobby, so we'll move on to our special guest. And our special guest tonight is well known to our listeners and people who watch our podcast. He's been a guest on our podcast back in July of 2020, November 22, and most recently November 24. He's the author of Hut Hut Hike, How Football Became Football, Fields of Friendly Strife, and A History of Football. He combines years of research experience and the insight of a former college football coach to illuminate football's past and its relevance to the modern game. His newest book, which is When Football Came to Pass, will be the topic of today's show and will be reviewed in the winter issue, our upcoming issue of Gridiron Greats Magazine. I'd like to welcome to our show once again our good friend of the podcast and the magazine, Mr. Tim Brown. Tim, thanks for coming.
Hey, guys. Yes, my pleasure. I do have to make a correction, though. This is my 5th appearance, because I was also
I was
on episode 19, 1964, 118, and 148. So I've been on 3% of your podcasts. almost as much as Joe.
You're a five timer.
Have your tailor call me so that I can get the fitting smoking jacket.
Oh my god, SNL skit is so funny, that has the five timer when Tom Hanks makes it. But yeah, Bob beat me to the
I
love that.
Wow. So, you know, I don't know. I just want my due. That's all.
Well done. 3% of the shows. Thanks for doing the math there. I love it.
It's Sorry about that. I apologize. But
Yeah,
again,
no,
I'm starting to
that's
forget about everything as I'm getting older. So, I mean, I'm lucky I'm even doing this, let alone
it.
trying to keep track of how many I have. It's funny because I do have a notebook and I write down. I don't type in, but I write down physically all the podcasts we've done over the years. And again, we were on the old network with the Leatherheads of the Gridiron. Then we did our independent, and now we're on Sports History Network. And I go back to a lot of podcasts I did in the early 10s for Leatherheads of the Gridiron, and in the late 00s. And it's, I can't believe something. I don't even remember being on these shows, but I guess I was. Whatever. So again, my apologies, but you got a nice book here, and it's and like we were talking a little bit about it before the show. This was a nice one night read.
Let's hold it
We
up. Let's all three hold them up and get a
yep.
screenshot of
There
that.
it is. There
Captain, there we go. Look at
It's a good
that.
one night read, and if you could tell our audience how you came up with the idea to write this book.
Yeah, so my first book was about the World War I Rose Bowl teams, and that's kind of the way most football history books are about a team or a coach or a player, right? I mean, that's just kind of a game even. So my first one was like that, but then the next, four have been more, looking at football as a system and, how the rules work, how things evolved over time. And so I just kind of I approach it a little bit differently than maybe most authors. So a couple of years ago, I decided to kind of start a series that I just call the Football Archaeology Series off of my newsletter blog, and just try to find slices of the game that I can cover in 100, 150 pages, something like that, and just kind of dive deep and kind of figure out what happened and how things worked and how they. I really enjoy kind of the evolution of the
Right.
game. So, the first one in the series was a history of the football, which just looked at the football and how
Right.
that changed over time. And then, then I just was thinking about it and just said, okay, if there's two or three of, what are the two or three most important rule changes in the history of the game? And I'd,
Yeah.
feel pretty comfortable arguing that legalizing the forward pass was one of those. So, I just wanted to look at the forward pass and what happened in the first 10 years of its existence. I also look a little bit at how it came about and the rulemaking process. But it's just a, as it turns out, it was that first decade was a mess. We tend to look back on our personal histories. We look back on our careers or thing, whatever it may have been. And we just generally we look back at social history, political history, whatever, and we try to make sense of it and try to organize it. But the reality on the ground is a lot of it's just chaotic. Things are contradictory. That people just in a game like this where you change the rule and folks have to figure out how to use that change, and it was just a very strange period for a lot of people. And so they, I just found some really kind of fun oddities of how they first tried figuring out how to throw the ball forward after it had been banned, for the entirety of the game, So,
I remember reading a book where they're like, football was nicknamed, 2 yards in a cloud of dust, until the advent of the forward pass, till they figured that out.
It's interesting. I don't think there's ever been a time in my lifetime, and I'm 67, where so many different early football history topics have been covered in depth and make for a much greater understanding of the earliest games. And I'm talking about you look at your series of five books. We look at the recent book on Leo Lyons of Rochester. You look at Jeff Payne's book and Yeah, the
Pato.
Bruins. There's so many different new thoughts and new information to make it much more under make the game much more understandable. The sad part about it, however, it's a core group of probably, I would say, no more than 500 people in the country that actually are interested in it. You know what I mean? So it's great in a way because now we have great information, we have better information, we have a greater understanding of what's going on, so on and so forth, but yet it's still in a limited audience type of situation. I'd give anything to see the gods at the NFL say, hey, this is part of our game. We're going to promote it. We're going to discuss it. We're going to look at it type of thing.
I mean, they largely ignore the game before the AFCA, right? And
Well,
they,
yeah.
or whatever it was called.
Well, no, I mean they're ignoring, to me, they're ignoring the game before the merge in 1970. That's the way I really look
And
at it.
that's true as well. Well, and part of it is I think is just that, the game is they primarily market visually. And if you don't have film,
That's good.
you can do the Burns style, montage of still images, but it's just not as cool as video. So there's just a lot of games are played and there's no motion evidence, there's no movie available of it. So
That's a very good point. I mean, it's hard to embrace it. At the beginning of some of the games, they'll show this montage of running backs. And I'm constantly pinging my son. It's like, can you name, these people? Because it's like, Barry Sanders, Walter Payton. And then there's a flash of Red Grange in there. And that is incredibly unusual that they would include a black and white little snippet of that. But well, again, Tim, thanks for being on the show. Thank you for sending this to me. I really appreciated your inscription, and you put a C note in mine when you mailed it off. So thank you very much for that. That's really valuable.
I put two of them in there, so maybe the post office took one.
Oh, that's interesting. And your inscription right here, Joe, you are the best co-host, comma, perhaps host someday to one of the most knowledgeable football people. You fit all that in that one line. So yeah, thank you for
That's
that.
true.
Really good. I like I said, I went to a Halloween party last night where they had an open bar. So I got started on it before I went and tried to finish it this morning. Some really good intro. Like I really love how you break this down. I mean, the underhand throw, I was really not understanding how that was going. And then you're like, hey, this is how officials pass the ball around. And immediately I'm like, oh, I get it. Okay. That made, I really like that little touch. This photo cracked me up.
Yeah.
I've never seen that one before. And I'm like, okay, that one's pretty interesting.
That's on the cover too. I mean, I modified
Oh,
it
I didn't even
to
notice.
I used
Okay.
AI to modify it and turn it into a
I didn't
cartoon, but
notice that. This was interesting. This picture of Red Grange, courtesy of Jeff Payne. And I was like, I thought we knew each other pretty well. You could have reached out to me for that. And Jeff, old Jeffy, even got an acknowledgement in the back. And Jeff allowed me to include his photo of Red Grange. And I'm like, what the heck?
You gotta.
All right. But
I didn't know. I mean, frankly, it was one of those things where I stumbled across. I saw the image probably on VFC or something, and it was like, oh, he's got his thumb on the laces rather than his fingers. So that'd be a great one to include. So I gained permission.
Oh, there it is. Let me put my bookmark back. See that. Really interesting. I love your books, and I dig at the back how you're like, here's the, here's all the books I have, and I'm like, God, these are good. I remember these. You, as Bob mentioned, your deep dives on, not a person but a topic, something, about the game. I really dig and appreciate. How do you pick a topic? And how long does it take for you to do a deep dive and research that topic?
Yeah, so I guess there are some topics I'd like to do, but I know I can't access the information, right? So I,
Steve Largent, yeah.
There's like early black football and the HBCUs. I'd love to do some research on that. Right. But the kind of research I've done so far on that area tells me there's, information isn't there, at least that's accessible to me. So part of it is just, like this particular topic, I had done enough research to know that there's information out there, and I rely primarily on newspaper archives, old coaches' books, and some magazines, and then university archives and yearbooks and things like that. So I knew that I could dig into this thing and figure out what happened in that first decade. But I was actually surprised how little information was available in many ways. I mean, there were certain things, especially like things like the throwing techniques. I mean, part of the story is that in the first year of the forward pass, 1906, I documented at least 9 ways that teams threw the ball. And we know that the overhand spiral is the right way. We've got 120 years behind us to show that that's been the case, but they had no idea. The rule was changed and all of a sudden you can throw the ball forward, and they kind of relied on the way that they used to throw the ball forward illegally,
from time to time. And the ball was a different shape there. I mean, they had the watermelon ball too.
Sure. It was, it was a big ball. So it took me, a little over a year. Thankfully just again, staying on the throwing techniques topic, that wasn't something that it doesn't get documented today either, right? But it wasn't documented in the newspapers other than here and there you'd find some stuff. But, I was able to get a hold of Eddie Kokoms, who was a coach of St. Louis U, who's kind of the father of the forward pass. He wrote some materials, appeared in some of Walter Camp's publications. Mm-hmm. Pop Warner, who was one of the big innovators, he published a correspondence course during that period, 1908 to 1910, and then that kind of turned into his books of 1912. So he had some stuff, and then I was able to get a copy of a 1921 book by Elmer Berry, who was one of the coaches at Springfield, and they were among the top innovators. Not so much him, but the previous coach. So, I mean, it took a while to try to find the information, and I found enough of it to be able to, be confident that, what I was saying was, the case. But, and there weren't statistics available then, right? Yeah. So you have no sense, there's no way to know how many times, did they average 2 passes a game in the first year and then 4 and then 6 and 8? I mean, those kinds of statistics, didn't come around until the late 30s. And even then they were spotty. So, I mean, those were some of the challenges and why it took a little bit longer than I actually thought that it would.
How did this compare to your other books? I mean, you said it took a year for you to do the research. Was that a long amount of time for you in your previous 4?
Well, the one before that took about a year. Okay. The last 3 have been about a year, maybe a little bit more. How football became football and Fields of Friendly Strife, both of those took longer. But, I was gainfully employed at one level or another during that time. Now I'm not so gainfully. I'm just able to put more time into it.
Yeah.
But also I've just gotten better at it. I'm approaching, smaller approachable topics. So it's like you kind of quickly exhaust the information that's available. And then, but still, I stumble across stuff, every day, that's something new, right? I just got an email from somebody who's a former NFL exec, and he's telling me, "Hey, you're wrong about this."
interesting.
So that was cool. I mean, it's really, it's kind of cool, to to learn. I mean, the whole thing is, I'm telling you what I know as of this day, right? But there's other kernels of information out there, and
That's got to be so funny to send this off to print and then get an email from someone like, 6 months later, somebody reads and it's like, that's not entirely correct. And you're like, shoot. Or you send the print and then somebody's like, hey, sorry, I was out of the country. Here's a response to your email and it contradicts what you put in the book or something like that.
And I will tell you that the change was that I had said the NFL ball hasn't changed since 1935, and there was a quarter inch tolerance change in 1988.
Oh,
So
wow.
that's the difference, But
Wow.
anyways, I mean, it's one of those things like, had I known that, I would have put it in, but
Well, Tim, you bring up a good point. You're narrowing down the information, so there is a theoretically limited amount of information on this one topic of one area. And I think in this book, you definitely, again, we all know what the ball, how things are thrown today. There's variations on plays, so on and so forth. But back then, it was really fascinating for me to again see, the underhand throw, almost a lateral throw, and how teams were very, very, fearful of using the forward pass because it was pretty revolutionary at the time, and it also, was basically done to eliminate some of the brutality of the sport. Amazing, some of the original points if the ball was not caught, then it was automatically down, so on, and things of that nature. So that's very interesting. In writing this book, did you have any unique experiences or stories you could share with us with regards to this whole concept of how passing came about?
Well, I think, you just touched on what I thought was the most interesting thing of, probably of, or one of the two most interesting things, that I dug up. So one is just the kind of crazy ways that they threw the football in the first few years. And it's one of those things I, my best way to try to get people to understand it is to say, if we outlawed the overhead spiral tomorrow, how would you throw the forward pass? Right. And so, you'd have to modify a lot of things about how you construct plays. And because the forward pass allows, or the overhead spiral allows you to throw the ball far, accurately, and with speed. And none of the other methods did that. But, they might do one of them, they might do
And
two.
high over defenders.
And so, like the underhand, I mean, we use that here and there today, but it's mostly gone the way of the buggy whip. So that was, I think just the, I knew that there were reasons, I knew that the forward pass was slow to be embraced early on. And I just assumed most of it was the rule restrictions. And in fact, I think that certainly played a part. The other things were just the challenge of figuring out, how do I throw this ball? How do I construct plays? I mean, what do I do with my linemen? How do you pass block? How do you, I mean, they didn't have named routes for 15 years or more, or at least they weren't common. So just things that we just consider so basic to the forward pass of today, they had to figure it out, and it was a lot of baby steps to get there, and a lot of mistakes and errant ways. But that whole thing was a lot of fun, and just even for a lot of coaches, coaches were part-time back then, and athletes were part-time, and so they just didn't have that. They didn't have the time to devote to developing these entirely new offenses. And so they kind of waited till somebody else came up with something better and then copied them. I mean,
How much of that is the size of the ball, though? Because I remember like reading something years ago about, the watermelon ball. I mean, and no threads, and I mean, you're basically just lobbing it. It'd be like throwing a big dodgeball, a big heavy wet dodgeball.
Yeah.
I mean, and eventually that went a little streamlined. There's a video of Tom Brady explaining the aerodynamics of it and spinning, and I mean just like rifling of a bullet, spinning the ball makes it more accurate.
Yeah, I mean, so the size of the ball definitely had an impact. But I think so the ball changed size in 1903. A lot of people say it was 1912, but it wasn't. It was already changed in 1903.
Oh.
They codified it, made it official in 1912. They said, here's the dimensions you have to follow.
Okay.
And then the NCAA changed it again in 29 and 34. And then basically with a couple of really minor tweaks, the ball has remained the same size since 34. Now, the 1906 ball, not only was it fatter, so the Eddie Kokoms claimed you had to have big hands to throw it. So he actually was arguing for a smaller ball at the end of the 1906 season. But it also the leather was not as pebbled, and they hadn't
Wow.
developed the tanning process to make it tacky. That really came with the Duke ball. And the laces were basically the same kind of rawhide strips that you use to lace a glove, a baseball glove. So, you didn't get, as you release the ball, you couldn't get the same, it was a single layer, not the double lacing we have today. So, you couldn't get the same spin on the ball. So they adapted it. One of the styles was this open-handed or loose grip style. And like Walter Stefan, the guy on the cover and you showed the picture of, he threw the ball that way. And he was an All-American doing it. So, they figured out how to do it. It just wasn't as effective as the way it's done today.
How interesting. You've got, I mean, in the back here, you've listed the other books you've read. How Football Became Football with Jim Thorpe on the front is still sitting on my desk at home. I hate to say it, I made about 75% of the way through and then got distracted by another one. Fields of Friendly Strife, Football Became Football, Hut Hut Hike, and the History of Football, which was another really good one. And now number five. I asked you before how long it takes you to research, for a book, but out of all of these, do you have a favorite, one that you found more interesting or difficult to research?
Well, it's kind of like asking if I have a favorite child, right?
Yeah.
There are times that I like one more than another, but that passes fairly soon.
Yeah.
I think they're all kind of different, and I just the what I like most about this one is just, I mean, it carries on the theme that I kind of developed in How Football Became Football, but it gets into how the game evolved in one focused area that is now, the forward pass now dominates the game. It is what football is about.
Absolutely.
And so, so it was just in that respect, I think it does, it's a fun look at a specific aspect of the game that I think very few people recognize. I mean, I'm probably as deep into some of this stuff as anybody, and I had no idea. I mean, that's half the fun of doing a book is, you're learning stuff and your things you've assumed all along turn out not to be true. So in that respect, I would say this was really eye-opening. Like the history of the football was a lot of fun. I enjoyed doing
Yeah.
that, but it was more boom, 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 just a fact-finding thing. And I didn't like in, it didn't change really my understanding of a lot of the game. This one really did. It really changes how I view that early challenge of trying to figure out what to do now that they've told us that we can throw the ball forward.
Hard to figure that out. There's really an interesting interview of Tom Brady after he won, I forget what Super Bowl, and some reporter's like, yeah, you have five Super Bowl rings now or whatever it was. Which one's your favorite? And he said, the next one will be favorite.
Yeah.
And I was always like, that is really classy. That's a great way to put it. So, yeah.
Tim, this is a little off topic, and I threw it out there because I've had several people ask me what my feelings are. And Joe, I'll ask you the same thing too. What are your feelings about this big push into the World Football League by the NFL, with these games now literally every Sunday from another, part of the world? And with the new thing that I just found out about from my son-in-law is that an NFL game is going to be in Melbourne, Australia next year. So, any thoughts on that? Any comments? I'm curious.
Well, I mean, to me, there's a certain amount of, it's like the college bowl games. They're basically made for TV. Most of them are just made for TV events. So it's kind of like they're just playing in a different studio, if they're in Australia, right? So none of that doesn't bother me or. I think it's kind of cool and it's a great way, if you're a Packer fan to travel to Dublin or wherever, it's an excuse to go. But in terms of I have a hard time seeing football becoming as popular in some of the other countries as it is here, until the day comes when they're playing the game growing up and just exposed to it from birth. Now, I do think that the flag football and the Olympic, the inclusion of flag football in the Olympics will really help that. And it'll make the game that much more approachable. You don't need all the equipment. There's plenty of soccer fields out there that they can play on. So, so I think that's going to help. But I still think even, overseas, it's going to be kind of like ice hockey is here. It's popular in the Northeast and in parts of the Midwest and everywhere else. It's kind of people who moved from there to the South,
I agree with that. And the one thing about Australia is you have Australian rules football, and that rules supreme over there. So to me, I really think the NFL is kind of pushing the envelope there, because in the little I've been reading about it, and to clarify, my daughter and son-in-law live in Australia, so I get a pretty good perspective, and my son-in-law is pretty up on Australian rules football. So said it's going to be a tough sell for a lot of people, except for those Americans who were, whatever reason, are in Australia at the time to go watch the game type of thing.
Yeah,
So,
and you have the time zone differences are just that much greater.
14 hours.
14, yeah, oh, 14. I mean, and I don't know how early they're going to get them there, but that takes several days to recover. I mean, are you flying there on Monday for a Sunday game so that you have 5 days to acclimate, you 6 days to, I mean, it's a tough one. And as
I
Bob
mean,
was mentioning,
it took us
it's
16 and a half
rugby's
hours.
big in Australia, New Zealand. I mean, the All Blacks. One world, I mean, rugby's big, and we compare rugby to football, it's a much more fast-paced game. Rugby is. So, I mean, yeah, who knows?
Yeah, I
The
mean, I've watched a Super Bowl from a pub in London, and we're up till like three at night or 3 in the morning, so but if you're doing that every day or every weekend, it gets tougher to watch. So.
I'm just curious. I love the titles, how football became football was tongue in cheek. And I remember reading that the first time, and I'm like, I wonder what he made, like football. Oh no, the football. I dig this. It's how football came to pass. But I mean, it's how do you brainstorm your titles? And then, what books you rattling around on that noggin of yours so you can get on the show a sixth time?
Well, I'm only doing it if I get the smoking jacket.
I'll talk to the producer, Ricky, about that.
I guess each one I've kind of noodled on. Like this one was probably my third. I mean, the title I settled on was probably the third title that I was planning on using. And then it was just one of those things that it occurred to me, right? It's obviously a biblical reference, but I just thought it applied. And so that's, each title just kind of emerges, and I kind of lay out a couple different versions, and sometimes I ask a few people what they think. This one, just once I found it, I was like, boom, that's it. So, the two books I'm kind of rattling around right now, one is A History of Fields and Stadiums. So, I just think there's lots of really cool things about, changes in the design of the field and then the stadiums themselves. But the one I think I may do next is A History of the Football Fan. So
Oh, wow.
it's kind of
Cool.
it's kind of a quirky thing, but so basically, if we didn't have fans, we wouldn't have football, or it would
Right.
have just be a club sport and go have your fun in the park. So, but the fan experience has changed over time. The game rules have changed to accommodate the fans, things like numbers on jerseys, I mean, things like that. And then just,
Timeouts. I was
yeah.
like, at the Raiders game, I was showing the guy with the green glove down there. And I'm like, the game is paced off of that. I mean, until
Yeah.
he leaves the field, they don't start the game. That's the time, that's the commercials dictating the pace of the game.
And yeah, so anyways, there's things like that. And then obviously, a lot of things have changed due to television, which is there because of fans watching the game rather than, so things are geared to television rather than, I mean, just everything we just talked about with the international games, that's all about television, right? And getting, getting eyeballs overseas. So anyways, I think there's some really, kind of interesting things about the fan and how the game has changed for them, and then just, how people develop different traditions in the game, ranging, could be the wave, or they used to do serpentines, snake dances on games at halftime, on the field at halftime. There were a lot of crazy things we don't do anymore because now the fans are fenced off then instead of behind the rope like they used to be. So anyways, I think there's some fun stuff that maybe I could do there. If somebody, there's one individual I'm thinking about maybe doing, but I don't really want to talk about that one yet.
Is he a Seahawk great?
No, he died before the Seahawks existed. So otherwise,
Otherwise,
Tim, as we're running out of time here, first, where can our listeners and viewers pick up your book? And then our last closing question, which we traditionally ask, and you've been asked numerous times, any advice for a beginning collector and or a beginning writer?
Okay, so the book's available, primarily available through Amazon, but because it's available through Amazon, you can also get it through Barnes and Noble, Walmart, some other places. So basically you just got to either Google Timothy P. Brown or the name of the book, When Football Came to Pass, and you'll find ways to access it. I've had a few people who reach out to me and say they want to buy it from me directly, and so you can reach me through my Substack called Football Archaeology.
Well, archaeology. And if everybody orders from me direct, do they get the $100 bill, or is that just for
Well, if they pay the extra $100 for it, yes.
they can get up.
You didn't have to pay for that. So and then in terms of just, for collecting, I really think, and I hope I'm not like telling tales out of school, but I'm going to write an article for your publication on RPPCs, so real photo postcards.
Oh, nice.
And I just think they're a really underappreciated segment of the football world, and largely because, if you want images of early football, that are reasonably good quality images. The only place you have is, there's some like university archives and college yearbooks. That's really about it.
Right.
And so RPCs were an inexpensive way for people to send a message to their friends or family across the country. So they're inexpensive, and they do the best job I know of at documenting what small college, small town high school, and semi-pro town teams. No other source documents the game like RPPC. So, and they're by and large, they're inexpensive if they don't have Red Grange or Jim Thorpe on them. Right? I mean, you can get them for 10 bucks.
Oh yeah, I've always said they're exceptionally undervalued. And again, I've said over the years, player photos, team issue player photos, and team issue team photos have been overlooked for a long time. Now they're getting popular, but early postcards, without a doubt. You do some searching, there's still postcard shows out there. There's still a lot of antique shops that have postcards. Any shop I go into, I look at postcards to see what I can find, by all means. So, Tim, that's great advice and great information. Another great book. I really appreciate you being on our show again, and I look forward to your article for our next issue of Gridiron Greats. And I also wish you well in your number six book. You will be back, I know. So, yep.
Hey, five timer. Thanks for being
Yeah.
on the show.
Yeah,
Thank
I need to have a pipe the next time.
you. Joe, we're down to 2 minutes. I'm going to hand off to you. What'd you pick up on today's show?
Well, as I said to Tim, I absolutely have a profound respect for people who grab something about this this beloved game of ours and do a deep dive. So just all the author, I mean, just some really good books. And you brought up, Leo Lyons. I mean, just some, boy, just when you think you have your arms wrapped around a hobby, something comes out of it. I did not know that. I mean, just, even Tim just talking about when the football became standardized. I thought it was like 15 years after, the 1906, whatever date it was he threw out. I was like, I had no idea. So,
It's amazing information, and again, I'm glad it's public knowledge. It's more public knowledge now, and it helps our hobby immensely. And again, I give the early pioneers of the game who played a lot of credit throwing the ball with that information. I mean, with that size of the ball and so on and so forth. That's truly incredible.
You imagine that? You've seen pictures of those old watermelons. I mean, people
Exactly.
collect those things and lobbing that. I mean,
Right.
imagine it's raining outside and that thing, weighs 3 pounds and you're trying to lob that over people.
Incredible. Incredible. Well, we're almost out. We're pretty much out of time. If you're not a subscriber to Gridiron Greats Magazine,
What are you waiting for?
check out our
Seriously.
website, gridirongreatsmagazine.com. Issue 90 is in the mail. So hopefully those who subscribe will be getting it over the next few days.
Look for that little
And
SWCC Enterprise upper left.
with the new PO box and the new address on the envelope at the same time. So we'll be back. Actually, we're going to have another show this week, and look forward to that. And until next time, thanks for watching and thanks for listening. Take care.
Thanks, guys.
Oh, wait a minute.
Sports History Network, where legends live on and the past plays loud.
Welcome to the place where history's proud, from gridiron glory to the hardwood stars, from the racetrack heat to Olympic bars. It's the voices, the stories, the moments you miss, told by fans and pros who live for this. Hook and Famic, the Sports History Network, where the past comes alive, podcasts and blogs that keep the flame high. From Babe to Brady, Alley to the Dome, if it's history and sports, then this is the home. SportsHistoryNetwork.com, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.